You're listening to Chris Smith on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
I was speaking a little earlier in the program about this ridiculous subject that's cropped up at the Australian National University, which is Indigenous Mathematics. I can't wait to see the textbook. But other more mysterious and, I guess, ugly things are occurring at one particular university in Sydney, Sydney University. A senior brain researcher who accused a Sydney University academic of attempting to bribe and blackmail another staff member is suing the institution after he was fired for serious misconduct. So this is one of these stories where the whistleblower ends up getting the boot by the sound of it. Professor Manuel Grieber, a leading neuropathologist who was the university's Barnett Cropper Chair of Brain Tumour Research, says he was sacked because he made serious allegations about university management. They don't like it in universities when you start to question their management. The university maintains action was taken against Grieber solely due to his ongoing misconduct, which included not showing up for classes and installing a surveillance camera and had no connection to his complaints. That's what they say. The 62-year-old academic who was fired in November is suing the university in the Federal Court of Australia, alleging the institution unlawfully took adverse action against him after making public interest disclosures and that he was wrongfully dismissed. In the statement of claim, Grieber said he had been employed by the university since 2009 and had an unblemished record until May 24, 2021, after 2 months after he made a complaint about university management. So after all those years at the university, all those years from 2009, it's only 2 months after he makes this complaint that all of a sudden he's seen as carrying out misconduct. That sounds awfully convenient and coincidental. On that day, he was accused of misconduct relating to the unauthorized installation of a security camera in his office, in his own office. He was accused of further misconduct in April 2022 and May 2023. The statement of claim said the university's allegations against Grieber were made as a result of an email he sent to the vice chancellor. Well, who will turn out to be right with that one? You just have to have a look at some of the allegations that were made against the University of Queensland over their close ties with the Communist Party in Beijing. Well, they moved heaven and earth. They employed teams of public relations experts to try and smother that story, smother those investigations. Universities don't like to be found out. Trust me. You've got to look up into the sky again if you can. Maybe that's difficult in Sydney because it's raining, but a spectacular comet is about to come into view for Australians before it disappears for 71 years. The Devil Comet has already been visible for Northern Hemisphere viewers, but prime time is fast approaching in the south. The rare celestial event will be at its brightest this weekend, and Australian stargazers are being urged to turn their eyes to the sky over the next week. Discovered in the late 1800s, it stands out due to its two bright tails trailing it as it shoots into space. The tails are caused by the comet's ice, gas, and dust being warmed by the sun. Amazing stuff, isn't it? But you'll be able to pick it out fairly obviously with a telescope. Together, the two gassy offshoots resemble horns, giving the comet its menacing moniker, otherwise known as the Devil Comet. Happy gazing. This is Chris Smith on TNT.
Connecting the dots, painting the bigger picture.
They always have great conversations.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Well, it's fantastic to have Evelyn Ray on the program today because Evelyn is a former New South Wales police detective, and some of what we need to talk about relates to two major criminal incidents in Sydney. Two incidents that have gained international coverage in the last 4 days. She's also a writer and podcaster with The Cauldron Pool and Sky News commentator as well. Evelyn Ray, welcome back to TNT.
Hey, Chris, thanks so much for having me.
Did I just hear a rooster in the background then?
You did. I'm so sorry. Farm life.
Maybe the rooster knows that you're about to come on to TNT.
He's a bit jealous. He wants to come on and have his bit to say, I guess.
Yes. They're posers, aren't they, those roosters?
Yes.
All right, let's start with the astonishing events at Wakeley in Sydney Southwest on Monday night, a terror attack by a 15-year-old and the most insane reaction to police presence I think I have ever seen. Have you seen anything like that before?
I have actually. It's funny, I was commenting on this almost live on Sky, and I was sort of asked a similar question, and I, you know, how do police handle this? Is this out of the ordinary? And to be honest, it's actually not. So often, perhaps in a smaller scale, but so often you're called to certain jobs and you're responding to that, and you're trying really hard to deal with something in front of you, but then the people around you, whether they be the witnesses who are there, the bystanders who are there, or even people who have heard about something that's happened and then got in their cars and ran straight into the situation. So this is something police deal with almost every shift in some capacity. This was obviously a larger scale, but, you know, I've been to the Cronulla riots. I was at the Lindt Cafe siege. I've seen, you know, I've worked a lot of Western Sydney in certain operations. And it tends to be when there's somebody in the community that is well known or well loved and respected, it tends to draw in people for a multitude of reasons. So it didn't surprise me, but it probably is something that we weren't, I guess, expecting from perhaps, you know, this particular crowd.
Well, because it was a church-related incident, I guess. But
yeah,
having said that, I've got to say, Evelyn, my instant thoughts went to a case that I covered as a journalist over and over again, which was the death of David Carty 27 years ago at the hands of an Assyrian gang in Fairfield. He simply walked out of the Cambridge Hotel, had some words with one of the patrons. That patron happened to be one of these Iraqi army deserters who were allowed into the country without questions asked. And all of a sudden, Carty was dead 5 minutes later, and he was even scalped before they left the scene. There is a little bit of form for that particular community, isn't there?
Well, there are certainly, like, statistics don't lie, you know. I mean, you can manipulate statistics, but if you just look at the hard, raw facts, there are certain groups of people, I guess, and certain things that tend to happen with more so than others. And I think especially when you live in a country that prides itself on multiculturalism, you're going to get all different kinds of people from different ethnic backgrounds to different religious backgrounds. And what that brings when you do that is not just the person, but their ideas, their understanding of morality. And, you know, I think that that's where these things tend to cross over. Perhaps what you and I were sort of, you know, brought up doing is not necessarily what other groups of people were. So that's sort of a consequence of that type of country that we are in. And so that also then makes it incredibly difficult in certain aspects to police as well, because sometimes you deal with people who genuinely do not think that they've done anything wrong. And then there's a sense of injustice, and then there's a lot of emotion around these sorts of things.
But we shouldn't kid ourselves. We shouldn't kid ourselves like most politicians do and say, oh, what a wonderful multicultural melting pot we have. It's worked so fabulously. Well, sorry, there are groups of various nationalities who exist here who are also born here, but influenced maybe by their parents or a mentor or a church or something, and harbour incredible angst and anger towards another group which may have replicated exactly what occurred in the Middle East, for instance.
Yeah, it's in human nature to have some sort of a loyalty to your mother nation. So you've got second, third generation Australians who are here who do have perhaps more of a loyalty to where their parents or their grandparents came from. I mean, I feel that somewhat to a degree. My father, you know, wasn't born in Australia. He was born in Europe, and I have somewhat of a loyalty to the particular country that he was born in, and a desire to understand those, you know, cultures and ways of life over there. It's just human nature. So it is, unfortunately, as I said, a consequence of multiculturalism. And this is why when there are foreign wars, such as what's happening with Russia and Ukraine, such as what's happening with Israel and, you know, the Palestinians, this is why it's super important who you're letting in and out of your country, because what you're going to see is foreign wars playing out on your own soil, because you'll have people over here who have a loyalty or who have an allegiance to one particular side overseas. And so what you'll see play out over here, and what you'll see, unfortunately, is an increase in violence towards different groups of people, depending on what's happening internationally. So, you know, you'll see different wars happening and playing out over here because there is somewhat of a loyalty. So if you and I say, yes, we are all for this particular country, then that leaves you and I vulnerable for the people who are living next door to us who don't like that country we have a loyalty to. It's just not all cultures are equal. And I think that it's foolish to think that. And I think we're being told that we must think that. And if we don't think that, we're racist. But it's totally wrong. The West has prospered and the West has been best for so long because, culturally speaking, we do have certain things like justice, like law, like morality, which do tend to, I would say, be a lot better for humanity than other cultures and things like that. But that's the lie that they've told us, that we have to be one big melting pot. And if we're not, we're bigots and horrible people and supremacists. But we're unfortunately, I think the way that the world's heading, the trajectory that we're on, we're going to see the consequences of this being played out and having this forced on us.
Yeah, very, very true. You make some good points. We Fat Shug on our chat box on tntradio.live says, Evelyn is spot on. People aren't as loyal to their new countries. One last thing on Wakely. I want to play what Bishop Emmanuel, the chief target of this attack, obviously, had to say today on tape. It was an audio piece about his attacker. Have a listen.
Love never fails. 1 Corinthians 13:8. Love never fails. Whatever has happened to me personally, I thank the Lord Jesus. It's a huge blessing for me. I forgive whoever has done this act. And I say to him, you're my son. I love you. And I will always pray for you. And whoever sent you to do this, I forgive them as well. In Jesus' mighty name. I have nothing in my heart but love for everyone. Whether that person is a Christian or not, it's totally beside the point. The Lord Jesus always taught us to love one another. Love God and love your neighbor like yourself. Whoever that neighbor is, we need to love them and respect them as we love and respect ourselves. So I have forgiven them. I'm praying for them. And for this young man, I say to you, you're my son, and you'll always be in my prayers. May the Lord Jesus forgive you. May the Lord Jesus bless you and show you the way, my dear son.
Evelyn, an extraordinary act of forgiveness.
Look, this is Christianity. This is the gospel. You know, I'm a Christian myself. And, you know, when I was listening to what was happening basically live when all of this took place, the first thing I said was, if this particular bishop could speak and he wasn't being treated in hospital, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind one of the first things he would have said for the crowds who went in there was to disperse them. Was that this wasn't the way, this isn't how Christians, you know, deal with things with violence, you know, and that's the beauty of the gospel. We don't win people with the sword. We win people with the sword of the truth, which is the gospel. You know, we go into nations and we disciple nations. We don't go in and basically use fascism as a form to make people conform. And, you know, love covers a multitude of sins. That's in Peter in the New Testament, in the Bible. And that's the epitome of what he's basically saying. And, you know, the best two tenets of Christianity and the two basic laws that cover all laws is love God and love your neighbor. And that goes out in many different ways. And so, you know, I think it's what he's doing is an incredible way to show people the gospel, to show people what Jesus does for us, because we are not more righteous than him. He died to forgive us. So who are we to not forgive others when he's done so much for us?
Yeah,
so
he's shown a great deal of leadership in what he had to say. And he was encouraging also those connected to the church to not take the law into their own hands.
Absolutely.
I thought it was impressive stuff.
Mm. Well, that's part of Christianity too. We understand that there's sort of three spheres of authority. You've got the family, you have the church, and then you have the state. And those three spheres function not approaching or encroaching on each other, but with the acknowledgement that God is above government, that God is above those three spheres of authority. And so as Christians, we understand that the state's purpose, which was given by God, if you read the Bible, is to wield the sword of justice. It's up to the state to do that. And so it's not up for us as an individual to take that into our own hands, that, you know, that was put in place for a reason. And true believers and true Christians understand those particular things. So yeah, I think he did a great job of being a great leader. And, you know, John Calvin said, if you want to judge a nation, you give them bad leaders. And what we're seeing here is a good leader, is seeing someone who can lead the community well. We've had so many bad leaders who lead people down the wrong way, but the fact that he was able to de-escalate the situation, that he was able to talk about peace and love through all of this, I think is a great example of leadership and the sort of shepherding that we need in our nation right now.
Yeah, very true. Impressive stuff. Got to get to a break. Back with you in just a short moment. Some developments related to Bondi we want to get to with Evelyn, and we'll do that after a quick break on TNT.
TNT's Mark Morano.
Politico: German transport minister threatens, quote, indefinite driving bans on weekends to meet climate goals. Yay! Roll out the barrel. There you go. This is akin to Stalin's five-year plan, the Chinese agricultural revolution, so to speak, where bureaucrats, usually mid-level, enforce these diktats from high-level bureaucrats and politicians from big summits like UN climate summits. And each sector of the economy has goals. And if you fail to meet them, drastic action may be necessary.
Mark Morano on today's News Talk TNT. If you're still wearing a cloth or surgical mask around in public, you're guilty of spreading COVID misinformation.
It really is that simple.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
I've got Evelyn Ray with me right away. What about the Bondi massacre 5 days ago? It feels like about 2 weeks ago. So much has been covered. We've seen so much about it. But what are your comments about Inspector Amy Scott's actions, Evelyn, in taking out that mass murderer?
She did amazing. You know, I think that she definitely showed her level of experience. You know, I think that she had a lot of intelligence when to use discretion and what to do with it. Something that we're taught in the police is to keep civilians away. So we're taught, you know, if we're going into a situation and civilians try to help, which they do, because it's human nature to want to help. It's human nature to want to get involved. But most of the time, what we're taught to do is tell civilians, nope, the police need to handle this and you need to get back and you need to stay behind the police line. Because the last thing we want as officers is to get people who are witnessing the incident, or, you know, bystanders who want to help. We don't want to get them in danger. We could get in trouble for that as well. But something that I found remarkable with this particular police officer is that when she was running towards the offender, she allowed about five or six men to run behind her. Some were armed with chairs and some did that. And she didn't tell them to go away. She didn't do that. She used her discretion to allow them to run with her. And I think that was very emotionally intelligent in the situation, that she had the foresight to do that.
Just in case she needed that help.
Yeah, and I think it gave her the confidence to be able to focus on what was in front of her, to look straight in front at the offender and not have to worry about her peripheral or her rear. And she could just kind of press on, and having that support with her, I think, gave her the confidence to do what she did. And, you know, we are, as much as people want us to be like Hollywood movies where we fire one shot and we hit the finger that's holding the knife and the knife drops out and all the problems are gone, it's Hollywood. We are trained to shoot at the largest body mass, which is from under the chin to down on the waist.
Oh, I had a few comments on the chat box, I think it was 3 days ago, saying, well, why didn't they shoot to the ankle?
You can't. Like, you are only legally even allowed to draw your firearm if you are justified in shooting it. And you're only justified in shooting it if there's imminent threat to your life or the life of someone else, or there's imminent threat of grievous bodily harm to your life or the life of someone else. And so in those circumstances, you are justified to eliminate that threat. And sometimes eliminating that threat is to unfortunately kill somebody. And mental health or not, if you shoot the ankle, they can still hold a knife in their hand. And I've seen it before where we've deployed a taser for somebody who has a knife, and tasers have two prongs. Both of those prongs have to land in the body. They have to go through clothing. They're like a little fish hook. They barely can get through clothing, and they have to be a certain distance apart for it to actually work well. So if you, the few seconds can mean life or death in these situations. So if an alternative defense tactic is deployed and for some reason it doesn't work, you could be dead or someone else could be dead in that time. It's amazing how quick things happen. And I think people need to understand that. And people also need to understand that this isn't really a police issue. When it comes to mental health, police is the very last line of defense. It really shouldn't be getting to the point where police have to shoot someone with mental health problems in order to keep the public safe. That's not a policing issue. That's a health issue.
Very true. Women were not only the madman's main target, Evelyn, but we've had a record number of women murdered in 2023, 2024 thus far. Should women be able to carry pepper spray?
This is a huge thing. I just want to say that violence has no gender. And whilst this was targeted at women, and whilst I can acknowledge that there are biological differences which make women far more vulnerable, and statistically speaking, women do have higher tendency of sexual assault and things. But statistically speaking, men are killed at a far more high violent rate than anyone else as well. Yes, men are the main perpetrators, but it doesn't mean that the innocent men are less valuable because of their gender. So I think when it comes to pepper spray, I think when it comes to self-defense, that it should be offered to not just females, but to men and women alike. It shouldn't be gender-based. But I do think that, unfortunately, I think that our defense in this country, our self-defense, isn't appropriate to what we're dealing with. If you look statistically, in the last 15 years, we've had a 47% increase in mental health. That's through the roof. And so you've got to ask the question, have we created laws? Have we created self-defense that matches what we're now dealing with? Because 15 years ago, sure, we didn't have these problems as much as we do today. We didn't have as many of the religious or socio or cultural issues that we have. So you've got to ask the question whether we're catching up with the times. I'm not saying that we should do what America does. I think the Second Amendment is fantastic. And I actually think that, you know, that good citizens should be able to have these things. But culturally speaking, I don't think Australia is quite ready for that. America have 300 million guns on the street. If you were to go into America and say, no more guns, let's ban the Second Amendment, all that would do is take guns off the hands of good law-abiding citizens and keep them on the streets. In Australia, we're very different. But something that I've been thinking about, something that I saw as well on social media, which I thought might be a fantastic idea, is something called Citizen Guardians. And it's something where it's voluntary based. Citizens of Australia can apply for it. And basically it's a permit to conceal carry. And it's only offered for people who are willing to volunteer to be basically dragged through governmental process and vetting and training and making sure there's safe handling. But I mean, there can't be a cop on every corner. Right. But you can have a civilian who's armed, ready to deal with these situations, because let's face it, it took a gun to stop a knife fight. Everybody tried everything else, but unfortunately, 6 people died. And there are also 11 more people who were taken to hospital. So I'm all for self-defense. Look at what happened. I think it was in Queensland. A grandfather was broken into by 2 men and he had his hand nearly axed off and had to be surgically attached. He ended up being able to fight back and he killed one of the offenders. And the police have the nerve to say we might be charging him for murder.
Unbelievable.
And so I think our country is a bit of a joke when it comes to self-defense. It's disgusting. And I think, unfortunately, if we're going to see an increase in mental health the way that we are, an increase in violent crime and all these things, we really have to catch up with self-defense. And I'm not saying let's throw a gun to everyone. Like I said, there's processes that we could do. But think about this, Chris. Imagine if one of those poor women who were targeted had pepper spray. All I've seen it. I've been pepper sprayed before. Heck, you just need a tiniest drop and it almost blinds you. Imagine the difference that that could have made in these women's lives, because winning a fight doesn't mean you get the final punch. The guy's unconscious and you stand over the body and you hold up the big trophy. Winning a fight is getting away from a violent situation with your life intact. And sometimes all you need for that is a few seconds of time. So if these women had oleoresin, capsicum spray, pepper spray, whatever it is, and were able to get effectively a tiny little bit in his eyes, it could have afforded them 3 seconds. And that's all it would have taken for them to be able to run and flee for their life. So I definitely think Australia is very pitiful and disgusting with their self-defense laws. We aren't even in this country allowed to purchase slash-proof, knife-proof vests or bulletproof vests. It's against the law. They are classified as illegal weapons. And so I just think it's quite disgusting that these violent things keep going on and our government aren't willing to have a conversation about what we are allowed to do, us law-abiding citizens are allowed to do to protect ourselves, because let's face it, we can't have a cop on every corner. So what are we going to do, guys? What's the answer? We protect ourselves.
I agree completely. You have nailed this conversation, absolutely nailed it. I had other things to talk to you about, but I'm glad that we extended that conversation in reference to self-defense. There are things that are just not being made available to your average citizen, and Saturday shows that we need to have a little bit more at our disposal, whether that's capsicum spray. But it's interesting you say both sexes should have access to it. Why not? Why not indeed? I'll let you go. Thank you so much for your time. Great to have you on the program. We'll talk again.
Thanks, Chris. Take care.
Good on you. Writer and podcaster for The Cauldron Pool, commentator for Sky News, and also Evelyn is a former New South Wales police detective. So her insight is quite analytical and, of course, coming from a position of great experience. It's good to have her on the program. Let's take a break now. We need to get you a news update right here at TNT.
TNT Radio News.
This is news.
Here we go.
Matt Boyland here with your TNT headlines. Beijing has hit out at Australia after Canberra announced it was injecting an extra $50 billion into its armed forces over the next 10 years to help counteract China in the Indo-Pacific.
China firmly opposes this. We hope that Australia will correctly understand China's development and strategic intentions.
And Washington has reportedly agreed to spare WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange the death penalty if he is extradited to the US on espionage charges.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk. TNT Radio. TNT Radio.
All right, when it comes to the major political parties in the West, often the so-called Conservative Party is not conservative at all. It's almost as if they could not care less about the views of their core constituency. And I can't tell you how many times on the various television programs I've hosted and the radio programs I've hosted, hearing from genuine conservative listeners and viewers who are just bemoaning the fact that their Conservative Party has vanished, poof, into thin air. You know, as when Prime Minister Scott Morrison signed Australia up to net zero carbon, or when he pushed through those draconian COVID policies and then took over several cabinet portfolios without telling anyone, he was acting almost like a communist or fascist dictator. Now, my next guest wrote about this failure of so-called conservative parties in a recent article. It was titled, Libs Must Play to Win. It was published in The Spectator. Let's go to Professor James Allen. He is the Garrick Professor in Law at the University of Queensland. Before arriving in this country in 2005, he spent 11 years teaching law in New Zealand and before that lectured law in Hong Kong. He's a native-born Canadian who practiced law in a large Toronto law firm and at the bar in London before shifting to teaching law. He's with us right now. James Allen, welcome to TNT once again.
Thank you, Chris.
We couldn't get enough of you last week, so we decided to bring you back, you see.
Well, gee, that's unusual. Certainly doesn't describe my university life.
Well, the Greens Climate Change Action Bill 2006 called for emission targets of 20% below 1990 levels by 2020 and 80% below 1990 by 2050. Today, the Liberal Party, in its support for net zero, is more radical than the Greens. When you think about those comparisons back to 2006, it's just another prime example, which you've written about beautifully in The Spectator, where conservatives have simply lost the plot. Why don't they know who they are?
Well, lots of theories on that. By the way, I write for The Spectator Australia, which is a branch of The Spectator. But yeah, look, if you look around the Anglosphere world, I mean, the Tories have been in power in Britain for 13 years. You can't point to a single conservative sort of thing they've done. They've been running a Tony Blair government. And as you say, Scott Morrison was woeful. Maybe the worst thing he did is to say, you know, free speech never created a single job. He didn't believe in free speech.
That's right.
Clearly the basis of the capitalist economy. The man was a moron on that front. I think part of the problem is that the political class has become so sort of professionalized. They go through university, they join the, you know, sort of young liberals, and they've never really had a job in their lives.
They're always trapped in the political tunnel, aren't they?
Yes, and they live in the inner city, and they don't really have any views that would distinguish them from the sane side of the Labour Party, let's say, not the hard left, but the sane side. And they don't really represent the people who vote for them. They have, and some of them have a clear contempt for their voters. And so the problem is, how do you discipline these politicians? What they've done in Canada, which is working, is they don't let the parliamentary party pick the leader anymore, because the parliamentary party will only pick, you know, the sort of wet black hand brigade left wing. Sort of. In Canada, they have maybe 50% more people than here, but 36 million. We've got 24 million, 25, 26 million. And the Conservative Party in Canada now has 750,000 paid up members of the Conservative Party. The Libs have about 20,000. They won't talk about it. Let's say 25, be kind. Here's the difference. In Canada now, every single person who joins the Conservative Party and has been a member for a year has an equal say to MPs and everyone else over who's the leader. And it's the party members who chose Pierre Poilievre. The party room would have walked over broken glass not to let him be leader. Mm. He's now 15 points up in the polls over Trudeau. In Alberta, the party membership picked a woman who wasn't in parliament to replace the sort of moderately woke leader, and she took them from behind to win the election. So if you leave it to the party, the people elected into parliament, they basically, many of them, you know, how many Tony Abbotts are there, right? How many Matt Canavans are in the party? Mm. And these are not radical views that Matt Canavan has. They're the sort of views that would have been sane in 2007.
Yeah.
You know, they can't even get into the shadow cabinet. So the real problem is, how do you discipline the political class? And we're in one of the worst positions in Australia because we have preferential voting. Terrible. Because what preferential voting does is it makes you somewhere on the ballot choose between the Libs and Labour.
Yeah.
It's a protection racket for the two main parties. Yes. You know, in first past the post, you can just not vote for your side of politics. You can vote for the monster raving loony party. And they will get the message. We don't have them.
You're right. Look, it's a conversation for another day, but preferential voting, boy, oh boy, have we got that wrong. I think we've also got the fact that we punish people who don't exercise their democratic right not to vote as well. But anyway, that's a conversation for another day. I know a lot of New South Wales Liberal people who are card-carrying members. They're split in two camps. There's the moderate section that think they've got to be right into climate change, they've got to be right into all the things that the progressives are into if they want to capture the majority of the vote. And my argument to them, and the argument that I get from the other side within the Liberal Party, is the fact that, well, hang on a minute, what are you there for? Are you there to exercise your philosophy as a political party? Or are you there to work out, oh, hang on, the majority of people want to kill other people, so let's go for the killing policy? Because at the end of the day, it's about philosophy. It's about what you stand for, surely, James?
Yeah, I mean, there's two problems with the sort of attitude about climate change, in my view. One is, if you go and read Steve Koonin, who was Obama's science advisor, you read his book Unsettled, there are all sorts of open questions about climate change. The 97%, you know, figure was made up. So I have some great doubts on that front. But even if you buy it right down the line, here's the problem. You know, energy right now is about five times less expensive in China than it is in Britain, and probably a higher multiple than here. When I got here in 2005, Australia had the cheapest electricity in the democratic world. Now we're pretty much the most expensive.
Yeah.
So you can have all the sort of government policies you want to protect manufacturing. It isn't going to happen. And so the real question is, what sort of moral framework are you bringing to the table where you say, well, we contribute under 1% of carbon emissions. So even if you think this is the worst thing ever, and I don't, but even if you did, China is building a new coal fire plant every week. And India is not far behind. So all you're actually doing is outsourcing manufacturing to India and China. We're not lowering worldwide carbon emissions. We are just saying, okay, well, we're going to be this shining example to the world. And when they see how it goes with us, they'll all change. They won't. They'll look at us and they'll laugh. I mean, the cost
of— I think there's evidence of that happening right now.
Well, it is. I mean, you know, they don't count any of the tens of billions of dollars of subsidies when they talk about the electricity price, which is a cheat. You know, it's not a market in electricity. It's a highly gamed, highly subsidized market. Oh,
without doubt.
So I don't—
So James, let's get back to the question that I asked in reference to what you've just said, in the context of what you've just said. Why shouldn't we, therefore, as a Liberal Party, be prepared to argue to the population that if we spend $1 trillion, we can't make any difference to the temperature of the planet? That is a fact. However, we're going to do our bit as a neighbourly international power, but that won't involve cutting our hands off or cutting our legs off economically. Why can't we have a leader that says that and explains that to the population?
I think the problem is really the libs don't understand that in the last 20 years, the world has changed politically. And I'm speaking statistically here, Chris, but rich people now vote left. 20 years ago, you had the Rockefeller Republicans. They voted right. And so the more inner city, the 100 wealthiest counties all voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016. Yeah. And, you know, Boris wasn't winning inner city, rich London. So rich people, and I'm generalizing, there's obviously except, but rich people now vote left.
No, you're right.
And the problem with the libs is they think they're going to go back and win those inner city teal seats, and they're going to design policies, you know, to get Frydenberg back in Kuang, or, you know, and when you look at—
Not going to happen.
Poiliev in Canada has given up on those seats. The winning coalition for conservatives is to win the sort of outer suburbs, the rural areas, and even some of the sort of not so outer suburbs. And these people actually will buy these arguments. But if you're functioning, if you're sort of tailoring your arguments to try to win the inner city elites who otherwise would vote for Teals, you have to be all in on net zero. And basically, the advisors live in those constituencies.
Correct.
The advisors go to parties. And
correct.
Yeah, and they do not want to stand up and say, you know, well, A, they don't want to live in the outer suburbs. And B, they don't want to stand up and shape policies that would be incredibly popular. We know they're popular because when you look, you know, Poiliev is sort of genuflecting a bit in the direction of climate change, but his policies are hard-nosed. He's going to cut the carbon taxes. He's going to build the pipelines. And so, as I said, he's 15 points up. And your listeners need to know, I'm a native-born Canadian. Canada's political spectrum is noticeably to the left of Australia's. If you ran Poiliev's policies in Australia, you know, Dutton would be 15 points up. Poiliev said he's going to cut the CBC budget in half. That would be like going out and saying, We're going to cut the ABC budget in half. I can't imagine a Liberal saying that. It's immensely popular in Canada. So, you know, they don't say any, they don't fight the culture wars, which I think personally is the most important political battleground going. You know, the wokesters have taken over all of the cultural institutions. They don't fight on those fronts. You know, they think that we're going to have an argument about whether you can take a bit of superannuation out to buy a house, which it basically just drives up the price of the houses, or we can have a little argument about tax rates. You know, meanwhile, you know, the Western inheritance is being, you know, pillaged by these people, and the Libs can't fight on any front. That's the real problem.
It is the real problem. When you talk about culture wars, that's interesting. I would have thought it's an easy argument. Like, you have a look at what's happening in Victoria under Liberal leader John Pesutto. He has defied, attacked, and isolated his own colleagues who dared to take on trans activism. That is just losing the plot.
Yeah, I mean, he has to go. He has to go. I mean, I loathe the Victorian response to COVID. It was the most thuggish in the world. Mm. And, you know, I would rather walk over broken glass than vote for Labour in Victoria. And by the way, when Malcolm Turnbull went to the election, I actually did preference Labour. I was so mad at Turnbull. But so it's not that I never vote Labour. I don't very often. But I mean, I loathe Labour in Victoria, and I could not bring myself to vote for Pesutto. I would go and spoil my ballot before I voted for that man.
He has
to go. But
He's a prime example of what we're talking about.
Yeah, he is. Well, you know, let's be honest. Peter Dutton is by far the best we have on offer. And, you know, he's not actually all that brave. If you want to see how the cultural elites are massively to the left, just go back and remember last year's voice referendum where, you know, they raised, what, three, four, five times as much money. The almost every two-thirds of universities came out for yes, none for no. Some were, you know, neutral. Same with the big corporations, Qantas, the churches, the NGOs. They all, and I exaggerate slightly, but statistically, almost all of them came out officially for yes, and they gave money to yes.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, the average person hated the idea, and rightfully so, in my view. So we have a huge problem with the disconnect between our cultural elites. Some of them are just cowards. They don't actually believe it, but they're cowards and they want to go to the dinner parties, or they don't want to lose their jobs, which is sort of understandable. You know, it's easy to, I don't want to pass judgment on people who might lose their jobs, but, you know, it would be nice to see a bit of bravery. I can tell you firsthand from the university sector, you know, there's 38 law schools in this country, and I think you could count on one hand, one machine operator's hand, the number of law professors who came out officially for no. I was one of them, one of my colleagues, and there are a couple others, and that was it. And so we have a big problem with the disconnect between the average person. And if a party decided that it was going to represent, you know, so the winning coalition for conservative parties in the Anglosphere and across the democratic world, we're seeing it in Europe, is to represent the working class, you know, the self-employed tradies, the rural sector, it's a majority of the population, which is why Poilievre's up 15 points and why I think Trump is going to win later this year. If you think you're going to win by being a centimeter to the right of wherever Labour moves, you know, the Mark Texter strategy, it's a losing strategy. It hasn't worked anywhere. It'll win you the odd election. So Chris Ifuli here in Queensland, you know, people are so angry. Like, he's going to win, but he isn't offering anything. It's just a... You know, he's
played himself as an unsuspecting target, a very small target right from the get-go, as soon as he became opposition leader. That's been his tactic.
That's because his advisors tell him to do that. And, you know, he will win this time, but he won't do anything. Mm-hmm. You know, people forget that when Campbell Newman came in, and he probably went out on all too many fronts, he got more votes when he lost than any LNP leader has got since then with the small target. You know, they're going to have a small target approach, lose seven elections in a row, and then they'll win one because people get so sick of Labour, and then they'll go back and they won't do anything. It'll be a Labour-like government. They'll bring in some sensible policies on youth crime. But in terms of, you know, cutting back massively, as we should, on the number of civil servants or fighting any of the culture wars, you're not going to see it. And let's remember, Chris Ifuli is the best Liberal leader at the state level that we have in this country. He's not good, but he's by far the best we have. He's better than New South Wales, Victoria, any of the other ones. So that's where we're at right now. And I guess it's, I'm going to say it's a disconnect between the political caste, especially in the Liberal Party, and their core voters. And we need some way for the vote, the party membership, to be able to discipline their politicians the way you can in the US.
Well, it needs to be a little bit more democratic, but what New South Wales has done and other state parties is to take the power away from the rank and file. Let's talk about that in a little bit more detail. I just want to take a break. I've got to take a break. I'm well behind on an ad break. I'll do that. I'll come back with you, James. James Allen, Professor James Allen from the University of Queensland, right after this on TNT.
While serving in Afghanistan, I was hit by sniper fire. The fighting was so intense, the medevac chopper was barely able to land. In the hospital, I was given a 5% chance to live. It's a good thing math wasn't my best subject. Today, I visit classrooms and share my story. I talk to kids about dealing with life's struggles. I tell them, with a little help and a lot of work, that you can overcome any challenge.
DAV helps veterans like Adam get the benefits they've earned. They help more than a million veterans every year in life-changing ways.
I know that some struggles are big and some are small, but they're all struggles, and you have to learn to get through them. With support from DAV, more veterans like me can live their best life. And as a new father, I have one more reason to keep on keeping on. My victory is being there for the next generation.
Adam Alexander, may your victories inspire many more. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
Internet crimes against children in New Mexico are real. And when it comes to protecting your children, the New Mexico AG's office and the ICAC unit are on the front lines. I'm New Mexico Attorney General Hector Balderas. There's nowhere to hide for online predators in New Mexico. We are working tirelessly using state-of-the-art technology and resources to seek out and find them wherever they are. Please talk to your children about the dangers that exist online, social media, games, and messenger apps. It's always important to know who you're talking to.
Help fight online predators in New Mexico by submitting a tip today.
This is the Chris Smith Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
I've got Professor James Allen with me. Former long-serving chairperson of Victoria's Essential Services Commission, Ron Ben-David, has warned complex time-of-use prices are hurting poorer households and fueling inequality. But Ben-David headed the National Secretariat for the Garno Climate Change Review and is a big advocate for the net zero emissions agenda. How can you be on both sides of that argument? On one hand, you're prepared to spend $1 trillion making no difference to the temperature of the planet. On the other hand, you're trying to say, prices are too steep when it comes to electricity. Talk about hypocritical.
Yeah, well, I mean, if we went back to the Stone Age tomorrow, and, you know, some people on the left would like that, it wouldn't make any difference, like statistically zero difference to the overall world's temperature. So this is virtue signaling in its purest sense. We're feeling good about ourselves. And the thing is, people can do that when they don't pay the costs.
Correct, which is why the elite and the wealthy are not prepared to go back to the Conservative Liberal Party.
Of course. And they, you know, you're not paying the cost. It's exactly one of the main problems with how they handled COVID. The people imposing the brutal lock, they didn't pay the costs. It wasn't their livelihood, small business being shut down. And their kids, you know, they got to spend time in a nice big house. My kids in London were a tiny little flat, infuriated me. So that, you know, what's the famous guy, the guy who wrote Black Swan, Nassim Taleb, he said, you get better decision making when people have skin in the game, which means you know, where were the politicians during lockdown or the public health types taking a massive cut in pay? They didn't take a penny cut in pay. They bore none of the costs. And that's the problem here. The kind of people who advocate these crazy electricity, you know, they make enough money, almost always public servants or, you know, think tanks that get public service money, taxpayer money. They don't actually pay the costs in any real sense. Mm. You know, if their ability to have a half-decent life was being severely impacted, they would not be nearly as willing to go down this path.
This is why I want to come back to where we just left off. This is why the advisors, those that live in, say, for instance, Sydney, the eastern suburbs, the wealthy parts of Melbourne, this is why they want to take the Liberal Party to that side of the political spectrum, because they too don't lose any skin in any of these kinds of games, but the middle class do, and it's the Liberal Party needs to go in search of the middle class now.
Well, it's obvious. I mean, I mean, you saw it with the pre-selections under Morrison, where they knew they were going to lose those, so they waited. I can't remember who the cabinet minister was who couldn't turn up for a meeting for a year and a half, and so then they imposed their own choices. And you know, now they want to do it through the sort of vector of saying we need, you know, women, we need to have a balance of women. Ken, no, you don't. You know, if you're a small government sort of person like me who believes in merit, you choose the best candidate.
Of course.
It doesn't matter what skin pigmentation or reproductive organs they bring to the table.
Correct.
And that's the problem. They don't actually believe in anything. They don't believe in freedom, and they don't actually believe in the private, they sort of believe in the private sector, but you know, they don't want to let the party members have choices because they know a lot of them will lose their jobs, as they have in Canada. And that's where we need to go. Once our right of center party is choosing the leader, and you know, the Malcolm Turnbulls of the world can't engineer a coup with the help of Julie Bishop, well, you know, we're going to get better policies. But until the Liberal Party, you know, they need to follow that playbook. And until they do, we're going to have a sort of enervated, emasculated, left-leaning sort of Liberal Party.
Correct. And you talk about those that are rusted on conservative, philosophical members of the Liberal Party. And I keep hearing from those who are so-called moderate and those who are part of the machine for the Liberal Party in the state of New South Wales that, you know, the old stages have to wake up, that we've got to move with the times, that we've got to change and amend our philosophy. And those that are rusted on as conservative voters, they'll vote for us anyway. And I keep saying to them, James, that is not the point. It's not about who you're going to get anyway or how many more votes you need to get, and it doesn't matter from who. It's about retaining your beliefs and retaining your philosophies.
The only reason they're going to vote for them anyway is because we have preferential voting. So people say to me, oh, I'm mad at the Libs. I didn't vote for them. And I say, well, where did you preference them? Fourth. I said, okay, where did you preference Labor? Fifth. You voted for the Liberals.
Yeah.
And they know that. And there's only two countries in the world with preferential voting, us and Nauru. And it's because it's a protection racket for the two main parties.
Yeah.
And it's a protection racket for career politicians because, you know, you can't discipline them. The democracy is supposed to allow voters to discipline the party, not the party to discipline their core members. And that's what's happening right now with the Libs. Now, it would help if there are politicians who agree with us, but it would be, you know, Tony Abbott agrees with this in my view. I don't know that for sure, but you know, he's just too nice. He doesn't want to criticize the party that made him leave. He needs to come out and say, we have a real problem with party selection and with the class of advisors and really let rip and put some pressure on Dutton. I think Dutton agrees too. But, you know, Dutton can't even get his own candidates pre-selected. The sort of machine, the background Liberal machine is very powerful, and they're not friendly to conservatives by and large.
I can't think of any pre-selected candidate at the last election that was genuinely conservative.
Well, look, Alex Antic is. Alex Antic in South Australia has had a bit of success in getting candidates pre-selected, and they're not happy with him. You know, who was the woman in South Australia who said, oh, you know, this is outrageous that he's gone and fought these pre-selections on behalf of somebody. It's not outrageous. Yeah. In fact, these are the kind of people who get real support. So
yeah,
there are some conservatives, but, you know, the idea that these rusted on career politicians who represent basically, some of them, basically teal values, and they are a little bit to the right of Labor, you know, but not much. I want to see them all gone. I mean, personally, I want to see every politician who supported the lockdowns gone, but, you know, I'm a bit Old Testament on that front.
I agree completely. You know, this is just a small point, but I make this point to as many people as I can when it comes to lockdowns. Nowhere in our pandemic response, and we did have a written pandemic response, which was contributed to by medical officials, nowhere did it mention a lockdown. We only replicated a lockdown because we saw them do it in Wuhan.
We saw what the Communist Politburo of China did, and then some people in Italy. Martin Kulldorff, who was formerly, he's a top 10 epidemiologist in the world from Harvard. They fired him because he was against lockdowns. But he's just reviewed all the evidence, and he said it's clear now, beyond belief, beyond doubt, that Sweden got it right. When you look at cumulative excess deaths, and then you factor, you don't even have to go beyond that, but if you want to then factor in how the economy did, inflation, you know, kids, there's a study that came out of Stanford that showed in the U.S. that the year and a half of missed school in some states is going to cost the U.S. economy $81 trillion.
Wouldn't surprise me, and the same for Australia. I've run out of time, James, okay. But
thank
I'm right
you,
on news. Thank you so much for your contribution to the program today. Much appreciated.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
No problem. Professor James Allen from the University of Queensland. We'll have him on again. I like what he says. All right, we'll go to a break because we've got news. Sonia Poulton on the other side. This is Chris Smith.